What were the other big changes? So, you were saying more people on the floor, and the well, can you recall any other change?
No, well, I'm not a very technical person, but they were always upgrading the machines. Dr. Cusick never stayed idle, and if there was a new development that would improve the papermaking, he was onto it. And I can remember this big roller coming in from England, and they had to knock down the side wall of the paper mill to get it in. They had to arrange with the Gardaí to bring it early in the morning to have a certain course, because the thing was so long it couldn't go around certain corners. So the route was all mapped out beforehand, and it came into the mill and it was pushed in through this big hole in the wall on the main Lucan Road. Mm. So that was always happening. There was always activity as regards to the equipment. The groundwood plant was another development. Dr. Cusick, they bought extra equipment from, it may have been America. So they were always trying to improve things. Mm. So it never stayed static. There was always something happening. Okay. That was the good thing about the paper mill. Okay, it folded in the end, but that was the sad part of it, really. That was very sad.
So there was a tendency to always keep it, to put what it was making back into it again.
Well, that was highlighted by every August. Every August, the first 2 weeks of August was the traditional holiday period in the paper mill, when the paper makers went on holidays. And during that period, the maintenance people were in full go. They were in there day and night, maintaining and upgrading the machines. And as well as that, the people who supplied the machines from maybe Germany or Sweden and England, they would be over as well. And there'd be a lot of foreign people in the mill during that period to make sure that everything was ready when the holiday period was over after the second week of August. That was a time for redoing the equipment and upgrading.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very busy time in the mill. Boiler house, the boiler men were in, they had a terrible job. They had to clean out the boilers. We must get talking to a boiler man. They called it sooting. It was so dirty a job that they were on double time for the whole period of the week. They were paid double time for the whole week.
Yeah,
it was a massive job, because the boiler was as big as our house here. You've seen a photograph of it there, massive, and these guys were cleaning it. They were like black all over.
Yeah.
My wife's father was one of them, assistant boilerman.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, she was.
His name?
Joe Brown. He worked there as well. Joe Brown, he was.
Yeah.
There were a great crowd in the boiler. There was six people in the boiler house. Mick Callahan, Jack Callahan, Joe Brown, Jim Bale. That's Olive Bale's father, the singer Olive Bale. Our father, Jim.
And did
there.
They have showers to wash that black off? Or into the river?
They did have showers, yes. I'm sure they had, yeah. Had air facilities in the machine room for changing and doing that, you know.
But, for example, Jacobs now, it did a factory, a biscuit factory, they provided a swimming pool and lots of other things. Was there anything like that?
No. The nearest swimming pool was the canal, I'm afraid, or the Camac. No, we no swimming pool. There was a social club started up there. I think it was in 70.
Yeah.
It may have been 72. And they have a pitch and putt course as well beside it. And it's still in operation. It was one of the few assets of the paper mill that was left. Left to Clondalkin. Everything else was sold. It was the only thing that was left that I can think of. The actual social club and the pitch and putt, that was left to the workers. But every other asset around the mill was sold.
Did you go through the whole thing from the time that all the turmoil, you know, when the changeover and change of management and that?
Yeah, I had ownership. Changed jobs as well. I had changed from the paymaster. I was appointed the office manager in the early 70s, and I held that position until 1979.
How did you get that position?
Well, I applied for it, and My job was to recruit new employees and manage the office, the facilities in the office. I had that for 7 years, I think. And then I was appointed credit manager. No, I was the only office manager. I was in charge of the office staff.
All right. And who were you answerable to then?
Well, I was answerable to the accountant, Mr. O'Farrell.
Yeah.
And he was my boss.
So that put you in a fairly important position there.
Yeah, well, I did all the purchasing of the office equipment and recruiting office staff, interviewing and all that stuff.
And this was after the changeover?
And this was 72. I don't know when we bought Cahill's, and that, I think... I don't know what year we bought Cahill's. But then I held that position until I was appointed credit manager when Brian Malloy came in. This was after Dr. Cusick wasn't the general manager at 79. He was only the chairman of the board. I think Henry Lund was appointed around 77 or 8. I don't know what year. And Brian Malloy was the general manager in the mill. And I applied for the position of credit manager. And I got it in 79. But I only lasted 2 years, as you know. The mill shut 2 years later. But it was a good position. It was a very responsible position because the amount of money that had to be collected every month was about best part of £3 million. And I was responsible for that. And weekly meetings were held to discuss how the cash was coming in or not coming in. And the salesmen were at that meeting. I was at the meeting with the salesman and Brian Malloy every Monday to keep tabs on things. What was the sales like and what was the cash like? That was held every Monday in Brian Malloy's office, Monday morning meeting. And even when the mill closed, I got redundancy. We all got redundancy notice around November of 1981. But the liquidator came in and his name was Bernard Summers. And he held me on. I was employed with Bernard Summers then until I left the mill of my own wishes in May of 82. I got a job. I was applying for jobs all the time because I knew this was going to end very soon when all the cash was in. So there was cash outstanding when the mill closed. There was over £3.5 million still to be collected.
From the
outstanding debts, you know.
The debts. Who were the people? Well, who were your creditors?
Well, all the printers in Dublin and the UK. There was a lot of UK customers. And, they were major accounts. There was hardly anything under 10,000, you know. There were 20 and 30,000 accounts, pounds per account, you know.
So. And why weren't they paying you?
Well, the mill was shut. They still had to pay. They had 60 days credit.
Yeah, but they... You know? Oh, I see.
Well, what would happen is in a lot of people might feel like reneging on it, on paying somebody who had closed down. So he had to be still hyperactive in chasing them.
Yeah.
But I met Bernard Summers later on. I met him in town. I met him in town and at the Chapelham and I said, how did it finish up? He said... One supplier failed to pay. That was for £10,000 of the £3.5 million. It was a fantastic liquidation. Fantastic.
And so, and that was Bernard Summers.
Bernard Summers, the liquidator. I worked for him until May, and I left in May, and I went to Trainer Farm Machinery as a credit controller in Finglas.
But if you were so passionate about the mills, why did you leave them? Why did you leave the sinking ship?
Oh, well, it was sunk. It was sunk the previous December. There was only a few of us in the office at the time, collecting money, and I knew I'd have all the money in shortly, and that was the end of the line for me.
Yeah,
I was actively going for interviews during that period.
Okay, to protect your future.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I wasn't looking forward to being unemployed.
I know. But I suppose you became so attached to it. And it was part of you and part of your families. I mean, it must have been very hard to see it sink.
Oh, it was. It was traumatic to see it sink, really. And Clondalkin village suffered badly from the mill. I'm sure all the shopkeepers felt the pinch because during the boom days, they'd be full of workers. The workers would be on their way into the mill. They'd be in the shops buying their produce. And then there was no money in Clondalkin. If if all these families were unemployed, you know. And a lot of them were older than me, and their prospects of getting a new job, Morris, would be fairly slim.
But with all the talented, skillful people, I mean, why didn't you group together and try and keep it going?
Oh, you could write a book on that. I mean, there were so many efforts to start up again. It did start up eventually with the cooperation of the Irish government. But again, it didn't last too long. They brought in a Canadian company to manage it. Now, I didn't go back to it. When I left in May, that was the end. I had a secure job. And some Canadian company were commissioned to run the mill. And mm-hmm. I think it only lasted about 2 or 3 years.
Yes.
But there was a lot of protest there. There was a lot of fighting to keep it going and to reopen it. A lot of negotiations with the government and protests and marches around the city and all that. But I was gone, you know.
Yeah.
I was gone.
But was there, I suppose, to summarise that and to look back over the different decades, if you look at the 50s when you were there and then into the 60s, was it almost impossible to see it go? Was it going so well?
Yeah, it was. And the other aspect of that too was that it was the last paper mill in Ireland and it was producing quality papers. A lot of people believed, I did too, that it would never close. It wouldn't be let close. That the Irish government or somebody wouldn't let it close.
Yeah.
I just didn't think it would happen, to be honest with you. I didn't think it would be allowed to happen, you know. It's a shame because it was an awful lot of skills lost to Ireland.
Okay, and talk to me now about the unions. Do you think the unions were a big cog in the wheel that brought it down?
Well, it didn't help matters that there were a number of strikes because the competition from Europe would have been intense from these Swedish mills. And I'm sure when the mill was closed down, and I think there was a strike around 78, I think it was for 10 weeks. There was a fitter strike as well in 76 or something. So there were interruptions like that which weren't beneficial to the company. So they would take their toll on the profit line. And people were demanding bonuses and stuff like that. And some of them were getting bonuses for other people's work because they were part of a team and they mightn't be pulling their weight. So there was a lot of, I think, inequalities, for want of a better word, that should have been sorted out. That didn't help matters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't blame the unions completely. I'd say the management had made up their mind to.
But did it change the mentality of the worker, the unions? Did it almost change their way of thinking? In other words, look, that's my job, that's your job, stick with your job and so on.
There was something like that because I know, as far as I can remember, one of the strikes was caused because some workers wouldn't move from machine A to machine B, and both machines were the same, and they needed, say, 4 people to manage it, and say there were 2 people absent or something like that, but the other two would insisted that machine A was their machine. They weren't going to help out by going over to machine B. Ridiculous things like that, if it caused a strike. It's not good.
No, indeed.
No, it's not good. And then it reflects on the union, who couldn't advise people to cop on.
Yeah.
You know? But they should have been able to read the signals that things weren't good. Competing against these Swedish.
Yeah.
I mean, a friend of mine went over to Sweden, Eamon Tully. He was a union official during the strike. And the company brought them over to Sweden, a few shop stewards and a few officials from the unions, to show them the way the Swedish mills were operating. And they were mesmerised by the so few people managing the machines. And some of them were managed by women, which, you know, so completely different from here. Maybe there might be 4 or 5 people. I don't know the exact figures running machine, or we might have 20. So that was 1966. So the cards must have been, the writing must have been on the wall then.
Hmm.
You know?
So the interest you've taken in it now, and the building up of the material and the permanent exhibition that you hope to have,
yeah.
is this going to be a permanent exhibition of memorabilia from the factory or from the mills of those days?
Well, I hope so. With the cooperation of the South Dublin County Council, who are commissioning this oral history, they will have all the material up in their archives, and I would hope that we'll be able to share them in Clondalkin by copying them or whatever, and having them down at the just opposite the site of the old paper mill. There are five houses there, and the round tower, and that site has been developed. Planning application went in today, yesterday, the 20th of May, to develop that site into a monastic garden, an exhibition area, coffee shop, and to be a tourist attraction and a local amenity going forward, because it has been neglected over the years, the Round Tower site. It's the best Round Tower in the country, the best preserved one, and I think it's the oldest. Not sure about that, but
thank you for telling me your story.
Thanks, Morris. Thank you very much.